bunch of the things that people have talked about in our community time this morning reminded me of a meeting that I was in this past week where one of the things we ended up talking about a bit was the importance of rhythms in our lives. And I feel like at this point in my life, I'm at least somewhat aware of how much this matters and how important it is to have what one well-known book on this matter called Margins. Basically, time and space for things other than, you know, producing the widget, getting things done, making a living, all that human doing stuff. Having said that, I realize that the margins are not always easy to come by, and so that's a challenge. And I've learned that, for me at least, this doesn't have to be about epic rhythms. This doesn't have to be about big chunks of time. As much as it needs to be about weaving the reality of the importance of rhythms into the sort of the fabric of everyday life, which is not always a simple matter either. But in some ways, I think it can be a little more open to our imagination than if we think it's got to be about heroic divisions of time, you know, sort of just exclusively this and exclusively that. Becoming skilled at, we've talked here before about how our brains don't actually multitask, they actually just switch really quickly between things. In some ways, it feels like that same skill set with rhythms of life sometimes is the way this has to work. We have to figure out what it looks like to rest fast, which is a kind of, feels like an oxymoron, right? But those kind of switching between spaces, which we can learn to do better, even in challenging times, but it's hard work. But that reality, that need for rhythms in our lives, that's one of the reasons why I still feel as though this idea, this really quite old idea of the liturgical year, this historic Christian idea that each year has important spiritual seasons in it, that's one of the reasons why I think that idea can still be a gift to us in the 21st century West. And I want to qualify that a little bit because I think that it could be easily misunderstood, particularly when I make a suggestion like that here in a gathering that stands in that tradition, in the sense of standing in the tradition of Christendom. I think it would be really easy to get the importance of human rhythms confused with the idea of religious traditions. And I want us to be conscious of the distinction so that we can blur them by choice, if that makes any sense. Well, a little bit more as we go. You might have noticed that over the course of Lent, I kept talking about this idea of putting things down or picking things up. And I did that instead of banging away at the ideas of confession and penitence, which are more conventional approaches to that season. And that was quite deliberate. I did that not because I don't think we sometimes have things we need to be really, truly sorry for or turn away from. Of course we do. I did it that way because I believe that these sorts of traditions, if they have endured over time, often have within them the sort of principles that open into a better lived life, whether the people that take on those principles adhere to a particular religion or recognizably religious set of beliefs or not. In other words, I think they are, we could say, pan-religious, if not irreligious at their heart, but have been taken up by religious practice. To say it another way, if something is true, it's true, it's true, however it's framed. And that, I believe, is testable. You can test that. But when it comes to trying out ancient wisdom, one of the things we might discover is that we can't test it. We can't discover the truth or not truth of ancient wisdom in a single pass. That might be roughly akin, if we were thinking about it as spiritual disciplines, as analogous to physical disciplines, trying a spiritual practice once and lamenting the lack of results is maybe a little bit like going to the gym once and complaining that all you got was sore muscles. Like, you know, who hasn't had that experience, right? Oh yeah, that just hurt. I don't think that's for me. But we do this with spiritual practices, right? It's kind of silly, but when you say it fast. In any case, what I want to explore this morning could be understood to be rooted in the liturgical season of Eastertide, sort of the lesser known cousin of Easter, which is the 50-day period in the liturgical calendar that follows Easter Sunday. It ends on Pentecost Sunday. As an aside, and maybe in this community most of you know this, but I'm not going to make much of this idea now, but I just want to, hovering back there, the word liturgy itself simply means the work of the people. We use it in the English language to talk about order, the sequence of things that we put events in. So liturgy is not a religious word at its root, although that's usually where it shows up now, but the heart of the word itself simply means the work of the people. And I think that's an important idea because when I start to think about the rhythms of life, I tend to think about human work that has, in some instances, a religious shape. But first of all, it's human work, not religious work. So I think the work of the people is an important idea when we're talking about rhythm. In any case, you might recall how we've talked over the season of Lent in this space about how the disciplines of Lent take a break for feast days, right? So if you're not drinking coffee for Lent, you can drink as much as you want on Sunday without violating the tradition, so to speak. It's a bad idea, but you can do it. At least with that illustration, it's a bad idea. But here's the thing. Eastertide, so under that definition, this just sounds like a hazard. Eastertide is one long feast. Like, there's no fast in the practice of Eastertide. It's party all the time for 50 days. I don't know what you do with the feast days. Like, what do you do on Sunday when you're already partying the other 6 days, right? But that's sort of the spirit of Eastertide. It's like this long woo-hoo in the rhythm of the year. It is from the tradition of Eastertide. I didn't know this until I was sort of poking around, because Eastertide is not a familiar season to me by practice over many years. It's relatively new in my own life. It's from Eastertide that, among other things, we get the whole Easter egg thing. Have you ever wondered? Somebody said this to me, like last week, somebody was passing around Cadbury Easter eggs at some place where I was, and somebody turned to me and said, "What's with the egg thing?" And I didn't know the answer, so I went to try to find it. It comes from Eastertide, eggs traditionally being a sign of new life. And so, again, an irreligious thing taken into a religious frame, and in the Eastern practice of Christendom, painted with religious designs. And so you get these symbols of the new life, of the lengthening of days, of spring, eggs. And, of course, if you're Cadbury, they're a profit center. So, like, that's irresistible, right? But that's where it comes from in terms of its history. Eggs have traditionally been a sign of the empty tomb, which has been understood to be a sign of new life. So there you go. There's the linkage. So there's this whole season, this whole month plus, where the historical practices of the Christian church can serve to remind us to keep our head up, to keep our eyes open, to be on the active, conscious lookout for the feast that is new life. Wouldn't it be curious experience if lovely things were unadulterated, were unmixed with complex things? Right? So I'm thinking about the what Sarah had to say this morning and what Tasha had to say this morning about the complexities of being a family. And I'm sitting here and I'm listening to that, and I'm thinking about it as somebody whose kids are older, and then Kim gets up to get something to drink. And I'm thinking, what does this sound like to Kim, who's just on the edge of starting a family, or to the other people who aren't here this morning that's the season they're in, or you know, like, it's these things are not unmixed, right? So it's just an important thing to kind of acknowledge when we try to paint a picture of something good. The good thing that I'm talking about in this instance is keeping our head up and looking for, watching for the feast that is the signs of new life. That's something that we might choose to do in a season like this for a variety of reasons, not unlike what I was just talking about. We might choose to keep our head up and our eyes open for signs of new life in this season because our personal spiritual practice has said to us, this is the season of resurrection. We might keep our head up and our eyes open looking for signs of new life in this season because we happen to personally believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus. But that's not the only reason we might do that. We might not believe in that at all. There are people in this room who don't believe in that. So that's not the only reason to do something like this. We can do it because we've had enough of winter. We can do it because we're learning how much being mindful matters to our overall health. We can do it just because we love, as I do, the new minted green of the poplar leaves when they come out. I am almost holding my breath at this, because spring's been so slow for that day. Like, to me, that is just this. If I have a biological icon in my life, that's it. It's that color of the translucent new poplar leaves. At this point, I'm finding my faith uniquely tested regarding the actual arrival of spring. Who would think about, waiting for a season as an act of faith? this spring is reminding me that it is. So, and the list could go on, right? The point is, this season is an important rhythm in our lives, and something like Eastertide can help to remind us of that and assist us in the practice, the conscious practice of that, which we need in our lives. We need hope for new life. We need a sense of something good pending that is coming whether we want it to or try to make it to or not. This is going to happen. There will be spring. If there's not spring, it will be the apocalypse. You know what I mean? Like this is kind of a big deal. It's going to happen. Those rhythms that surround us need to inform the way that we operate as human beings. And those rhythms are one of the things, because they're ancient, that informed the early church when they were laying out that year. So to think about something like Eastertide as just a religious tradition is to be rather blithe about the larger rhythms in which we humans live our lives, and to rather oversell the tradition. Now, when you pick your head up and look around, when I pick my head up and look around, one of the things that happens is that I start to notice things that I didn't notice before. Again, sounds kind of dull when you say it in a sentence, but just take a moment to think about this. When, for you personally, when was the most recent or maybe a particularly memorable time when you were in a familiar setting and you had a "why have I never noticed that before" moment? So just take a moment and think about that. Most recent or particularly memorable time when you were in a familiar setting and something caught your attention and you thought, "huh, I've never noticed that." No, you don't have to say anything about it.
I want to.
I know you do. Save that thought. There's a say something part coming, Sarah, if I may be so restrictive. We see what we're looking for. That's partly how we're just wired as humans. And that is all woven in with something that's been getting lots of press these past few years that often gets called confirmation bias. And one of the reasons that idea has been getting lots of press is because there are more and more studies that are making it clear that this is an extremely powerful part of how we experience the world around us. Confirmation bias, to boil a large thing down to a short paragraph, is something that occurs from the direct result of the influence of desires on beliefs. So this is an important combination. Confirmation bias is something that occurs as a direct result of the influence of desire, what we want, on what we believe. So when we would like a certain idea or concept to be true, what basically happens inside of us as humans, and we can't really stop this, we can be aware of it and adjust for it, but the initial thing kind of just happens. What tends to happen is that when we want something to be true, we end up believing it to be true. Basically, we're motivated in that loop by wishful thinking. And what that does, and this is the way confirmation bias functions, an actual fact, is that error, "I believe this to be true, so it is true," leads us to stop gathering information when the evidence we have so far confirms the view that we would like to be true. So when we've got all the evidence we need to confirm what we would like to believe, we stop gathering information. It's not very hard to see evidence of this, at least in my life. Maybe you're all free from this particular human characteristic, but I doubt it. It's not a flaw. It's, unless, you know, it's one we all share. It's not a unique flaw, let's say that. I heard somebody this past week talking about how this reality of our brains makes it very difficult for us to question our own beliefs and the frameworks for them. So it makes it really hard for us to ask ourselves the sort of questions that might shake up our own beliefs or our own biases. Of course. Right? And one of the illustrations that particular person who was talking about confirmation bias used was religion. And their comment was that the reality of confirmation bias should make a lot of religious people very nervous, because if they just ask themselves some bias-challenging questions about what they believe, they might find out that their present system of belief doesn't hold up very well. Now, I happen to know, because I have the privilege of kind of being the repository for all sorts of conversations in this community, that there are lots of people in this community and in this room who have done and do that work of asking those sorts of questions. Having said that, my personal experience would suggest that there really are limits to this. Like, we really do confront ourselves in this process. We really do come to a point where we can sort of feel, if we're paying attention to what's going on inside of us, like, this question's okay and this question's okay, but whoa. Like, when I start to even think about that question, something inside of me goes, yeah, no, I don't really need to explore that. Here's all the evidence for why. And I back away. Right? So we all do this, I think. I think it's just normal as could be. In some ways, this is a trope for me. It's that whole I prayed for a parking space when I was in a hurry and one opened up right in front of me because that's how prayer works thing, you know? That's great. That's a pretty tidy instance of confirmation bias. We wouldn't bother to pray that prayer if we didn't already believe that that's how prayer worked. Like, what a waste of space. Okay? If you don't believe God's an interventionist, asking God to intervene is like the dissonance is sort of easily visible, right? But if we believe that's how it works, and we go, dear God, I'm late for the doctor's appointment. I can use a parking space. Thank you, Jesus. Right? And we're like, the loop is closed. Like, we're all done here. What happens, though, if when we pull into the space, and we won't do it then because we're already late, but what if we pull into a space another time and it's a generous time, and we pull into the space and we sit there and we think about all the times that we were running late and we said, dear God, I could use a parking space. And there was no parking space. And we drove around the lot for 15 minutes before we found one, and we were just late. Did we get back in the car and go, huh? I got some questions.
Or you find a spot, and then you get a parking space, and you go, fire
hydrant. Right. A personal experience, perhaps, Sarah? Yeah. Right. Exactly. So we just don't like to do that work, right? We just don't, because it messes with the system. I resonated with that person's illustration about religion and not asking questions that mess with the system, not least of all because I've spent so much of my own life and career in religious settings where I kept getting the feeling that most of what was happening was that a particular system of belief was getting propped up. And sometimes getting propped up in ways that were knowingly disingenuous, or to use sort of a more sociological word, willfully blind. No one was asking the questions that challenged the prevailing bias. And the language that got used to defend that lack of questioning was truth claims. I'm not going to ask any questions about that because it's true. You don't question the truth. What happens if you question the truth? What happens if you question the truth is, historically, you get branded as a heretic. And as I've mentioned here before, the root of the word heretic simply means choice. But what turns it into heresy, historically, linguistically, is that there's an authorizing body that does not want that question asked. So it is wrong, it is damaging, it is dangerous to the truth. It's a heresy. So that's sort of the short history of the word heresy right there. So this morning, the first Sunday of Eastertide, I want to stay in that space of looking for new life by coming at what might be a familiar text to some of us from this part of the liturgical year. But I want to look at that text in a different way. And I also want to come at this by giving us a chance to give voice to questions that we might have but not articulate, at least not in a setting like this one. And I would be remiss if I didn't give credit where it's due. Sasha is not here this morning, but my core inspiration for this morning came from Sasha, who last week in community time articulated some of her own questions about what it feels like to be working with our little people and finding herself asking as she prepares to teach something, do I believe that? Great question. And how courageous and important and inspiring that was to me for Sasha to choose to speak that in community time. So thanks to Sasha from my vantage point. Where I take this might be nothing like what Sasha had in mind. But if it goes badly, I'm still going to hold her responsible. That'll be on the podcast, so I'm going to be held responsible for holding her responsible, so at least some accountability outside of the room, right? What I want to do is I want to read us a post-resurrection story from the Gospel of Matthew, and for the time being, I want to encourage you to try to not get stuck on the bodily resurrection question. I'm not saying it's a question that doesn't matter. I think it's an important question, but I also think that we often miss how practical these stories can be, how they can still speak. And sometimes we miss that because we're so busy debating either internally or externally whether what the nature of the story is, whether a particular body stayed dead or didn't, you know, so on and so forth. So I just don't want us to get hung up there this morning. And a reminder, as we read the story, the gospel writers, in terms of the way they wrote, were not particularly concerned with what we might call in the 21st century West the facts. Or if they were concerned about the facts, they were very sloppy journalists because they can't even agree about numerically either or matters, like how many angels there were at the tomb. And it's not like we're talking how many people were at the Washington Memorial for inauguration. It's not a big number. It's like, was it one, two, or three? You know? So they're not forerunners of a post-truth culture. It's just that the facts are not what motivated or propelled them to write. And in their cultural context, that's not unusual, unlike in our cultural context where it is, God have mercy, where it's becoming less unusual. Anyway, so here's the text. This is Matthew's version from Matthew 28 of some particular events post-resurrection. The Sabbath was over, and it was almost daybreak on Sunday when Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. There's a real surfeit of Marys in this collection of stories, isn't there? Suddenly a strong earthquake struck, and the Lord's angel came down from heaven. He rolled away the stone and sat on it. Matthew has one of the bolder angels as well. He parks himself right on it. The angel looked as bright as lightning, and his clothes were as white as snow. The guards shook from fear and fell down as though they were dead. I'm going to keep going, but some of this is just about irresistible in terms of the message the writer is sending about the nature of the occupying Romans. So there's a good, for instance, in the story of some of that kind of writing. The angel said to the women, "Don't be afraid." Right? you're having a conversation with a non-corporeal being, but just relax. "Don't be afraid. I know you're looking for Jesus, who was nailed to a cross. He isn't here. God has raised him to life just as Jesus said he would. Come see the place where his body was lying. Now hurry. Tell his disciples that he has been raised to life and is on his way to Galilee. Go there and you will see him. That is what I came to tell you." The women were frightened and yet very happy as they hurried from the tomb and ran to tell Jesus' disciples. Suddenly, Jesus met them and greeted them. They went near him, held onto his feet, and worshipped him. Then Jesus said, "Don't be afraid. Tell my followers to go to Galilee. They will see me there." There are so many places we could go with that text. But here's the place where I want to go. I want to go to Galilee. Galilee, at the time of Jesus, was one of the three provinces that made up the region known at that time as Palestine, which in particular was sort of the northern part of the Israel of that time. It's the province that Jesus was from. It's where he grew up. It's where most of what is recorded about his life and teachings in the Bible takes place. It's where he mostly lived his life. And in all likelihood, you could tell, if you were having a conversation with Jesus, that he was from there because of his accent. So people from Galilee had a recognizable accent. It was, by such reports as we have of these things, more guttural and more broad than the more sophisticated accent of the folks from the capital. Sort of like how you can tell if somebody's from southern Manitoba yet once already, or from Toronto, right?
Or from the Maritimes.
Yeah. Another great Canadian accent that I'm not even going to try to do. There you go. That's pretty good. So Galilee is Jesus' version of local. That's local. And I find it fascinating that the message this story sends to the characters that find themselves feeling frightened, confused, uncertain, afraid, is if you want to address those things, the place to start is where you live, is local. Go local. Go to Galilee. You want to see Jesus? Go to Galilee. Jesus says, "You want to see me? You want to hear what I have to say? Go to where I'm from. Go to Galilee. That's where it's going to happen. Go to where this story, go to where this person, go to where you, go to where I come from, and take your questions with you so you can ask them there." In other words, if we're on a quest to find our path, to find our way, the place to start that quest is the place where we live. The place where we have the experience that grounds us as a person. Local. I encountered a person that leads a theological and ministry training school here in Canada this past week who said, "I can no longer call myself a Christian." Remember what this person does for a living? Did you miss that sentence? "I can no longer call myself a Christian. So what I say now is that I'm a follower of the way." But I'm not going to take the time to break that down this morning. The short version might simply be that at this point in the history of Western Christendom, the word Christian means so many things that you can profoundly disagree with and still be deeply committed to a life of following the teachings of Jesus about how to live, that some of us kind of want to get a t-shirt that says, "I'm not that kind of Christian," except that's exact same game that we're struggling with. I know that when I put that person's complex struggle into one sentence like that, I'm selling lots of things short, and I also know that this is a person who's got lots and lots and lots of company, some of it in this room. So, in this Matthew account, we've got a bunch of people with a bunch of questions, and what the story says to them, as I've read it this morning, is ask them in the context where you live your life. Ask them in the context where you wrestle with everyday things, including your spiritual questions, your cosmic questions, your ethical and moral questions, your daily questions. Wrestle with them there. It is one of my most cherished hopes that the table can be an essential part of what Ask Local means in each of our lives, that we can, over time shared together, experience something in a place like this, in a gathering like this, that makes it feel like part of our local and a place where we can ask those kinds of questions. And when Sasha spoke about some of her questions in this context last week, that's sort of the moment that happened inside of me. I was just like, yes, that's it. We should be able to do that. We need places where we can do that. Could this possibly be a place where we could do that? And I realize that that's not simple. Like, I get that when, I know what it's like for me to come in here on a given Sunday morning and sit down and know the community time's coming and have the thing running in the back of my head that's like, do I really want to talk about that? Do I really want to open my mouth and say something out loud about that here with these people? What will they think of me comes to mind. What if I cry? Always comes to my mind because I always do. All these things, right? Do I really want to ask that question here? Do I really want to raise that here? God, I hope so. I had a big week for encountering fascinating ideas this week. Not unusual, perhaps, but some of them really stuck. And one of them was an idea that we're going to experiment with together for just a few minutes this morning. I'm a complete amateur at this method. So with that disclaimer, I want us to do something this morning called question bursts. And it turns out that knocking our confirmation biases loose and generating new thoughts and perspectives, that a better exercise for that than traditional brainstorming, which is about generating answers typically, right? That a better way to knock our confirmation biases loose and generate transformative new thoughts is actually questions, not answers. Jane should be doing this. So just help me from the sidelines, okay? Because I feel responsible now that I've begun. Okay, so, but yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's lots of support for this. I'm not making this particular idea up. The other ones in the morning you have to check for yourself. Okay, but yeah, all right? So because we're wired to answer questions, right? We're rewarded for answering questions from very early on. This is where we get the joke that sometimes pops up around here. It might have even popped up again this morning, I can't remember, but where the answer to all the religious questions is Jesus, right? In so many of the settings where we grew up, it's like, you know, yeah, I know that one. It's always the same. That's right, because we're wired for an answer, not for a question. So just learning how to stay in the space of asking questions and then asking questions about our questions is super important if we want to be transformed as people, if we want to actually be in a generative, transformative space. Which the Bible uses the ancient text that is our sacred text in Christendom talks about a renewed mind when it talks about this. We'll talk another time about the characteristics of a renewed mind because that's a fascinating thing to think through. All right, so just a quick thing about the exercise we're going to do. This comes from a guy named Hal Gregerson. Mr. Gregerson is the executive director of the MIT Leadership Center, so there's some street cred. Senior lecturer at the Leadership and Innovation, MIT Sloan School of Management, Moore Street Cred, author of a forthcoming book. This is all brand new. It was in last month's Harvard Business Review, which I read for relaxation. Not true, I just happened to run across this. But he's the author of a forthcoming book called Questions Are the Answer, a breakthrough approach to your most vexing problems at life, oh, nope, at work and in life. Hey? This may make you want to read the whole book. It may turn you off forever to Mr. Gregerson's work, but this is where this comes from. So basically what we want to do is a short version of something that he calls question bursts, and we're going to modify it just a little bit because he's using it as problem solving. We're using it as surfacing of problems. We're going to set, I'm going to watch my watch. I'll write these on this. This is really basically just an excuse to use this board here because I can write things on it digitally. Some of you are like, oh.
It says do not write or use tape on a screen.
A virtual pen.
Oh,
yeah. No, no. I checked this out beforehand. So let's see. Oh, yeah. All right. Here we go. So I'm going to write these on the board. You won't be able to read what I write, but the marks I make will represent what you said.
Just, the new norm, don't
I know, I know. Time for an upgrade. Okay. So here's a... It happens so fast and so naturally. I know. That's how I feel too, all the time. So here's a couple things about... Here's a couple of things about the nature of the questions, all right? We won't drag this out, like 3 or 4 minutes. We want to try to generate as many questions as possible. If we're really killing it, we'll like get 15 or maybe 20. Like we'll fill up the board. We'll see. But there's a couple of things. The questions have to be questions. You can't qualify them. You can't ask them in a way that suggests you already have an answer for them. They have to actually just be a full-on question. So no pushback allowed. The more surprising or evocative the questions are, the better. Short and simple is better. So boil down your question before you ask it. Don't ask it the way I ask questions. Okay? Do better. I'm going to try to write them down verbatim, not edit them. Because the inclination of the group facilitator in this exercise is, guess what? Confirmation bias, right? I'm going to edit the question so it looks like what I think the question should point toward. Not a good idea. And then I'll tell you a little bit about ways that you can question your questions. Okay? So What I'm after here in this exercise is basically questions that we have about the kind of the human-divine intersection, because that's what we're talking about all the time, right? So when I was practicing with the whiteboard this morning, let's see if this works. Like one of my outstanding challenger confirmation biases questions is let's see if this works. What if there is no God? Important question, right? All right, fire away.
For those of you that are following along on a podcast that weren't with us in that particular gathering at the table, what followed was a lively question burst where people just generously shared all sorts of substantial questions. It was quite conversational and difficult to record in a way that would carry well on a podcast. So let me just read for you what ended up on the whiteboard during that question burst. I started with, what if there is no God? Which someone followed up with, so what? And on from there with, what if Jesus was just human? Does God intervene? Why is there so much pain in the world? What if this, meaning a religious gathering or a faith community kind of experience, what if this just feels good? What is the meaning of life? That came from an 11-year-old in the community. Is all the ceremony necessary? Does God have moral dictates? If so, can we know them? How do we live without God? Is post-death as forgettable as pre-birth? Which God? Why is it okay for some people to live with nothing? Why pray? What does God mean? Do I matter? Have all our minds just been colonized? In the absence of God, do ethics matter? And is religion just social control? And I'll pop this summary into the podcast and then pick up with our closing moments together.
I suspect we could keep going, but we're going to do something dissonant instead. We're going to sing about God. Right? So, I'll capture this, and it'll be a bit of a litmus for me going forward. Super, super fascinating, and thank you all for being a part of this. Not necessarily the easiest thing to sort of wave your ideological hand and go, I got this question, right? But what a great collection of questions. Wow. I feel like a kid in a candy store. Like, honestly, what a great bunch of things to explore and have questions about. And we probably have a lot more. And we probably have a bunch of deeper ones that we didn't say because we were just testing the exercise, wondering who was going to go first with a bigger one, right? Because that'd be normal. And what I want to say is, as we go into singing together, into worship, which sort of has this wider context, the idea that God doesn't just exist but is present in some way or other, these questions are in our minds and our hearts and our lives. And that's actually not categorically a problem, at least not in this space. This is the both and of what it means to be humans, wondering, exploring, intrigued by, finding the necessity for, having a magnetic pull toward meaning making, a part of which has to do with answering or finding a framework for addressing questions that we can't readily answer. Historically, part of that answer framework has been conceptions of the divine, has been a conversation about God, has been religion. So this is the perfect context for these questions. This is where humans do or should do this work. It's not the only place, but it's a good place. Because we can know the other people in the room. We can know that the structure that we're in does not categorically say, you can't do that here. Disallowed. Nope. Allowed. Cheered on. Even enjoyed. Even though I know sometimes it's disconcerting. All right? Thank you, all of you. We'll sing together, and then we'll go back to, you know, asking questions in some other space.